Oliver Callan on RTÉ Radio 1, sponsored by Get Set Go. Get comprehensive car insurance today at getsetgo.ie.
She is one of the greatest writers ever, and once you've read her memoirs, you'll discover she's also one of the funniest. Margaret Atwood, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Book of Lives, a memoir of sorts. In the introduction, you're telling us you're hoping to settle some scores. You set out to have some fun here, didn't you?
Well, what's life without fun, Oliver?
Agreed. And you were laughing quite a lot as you remembered all the things that have happened in your life up to now?
Well, I was laughing about some of them.
Yeah.
And some of the ones that I was laughing about weren't funny at the time. But this is always the case.
It's such a beautiful and descriptive book. Did you have these incredibly detailed memories immediately to hand? Were you able to conjure them up? Because you've got drawings of places you've lived in and images and scraps and so on.
Yes, I have an inconveniently precise memory.
Right.
Some of the things you don't particularly wish to remember, such as throwing up. And I could have done a whole memoir about foreign countries I have thrown up in, including Ireland.
Yes, Ireland is very fresh in your mind.
It certainly is.
It was the mid-90s. You were living here for a brief while.
Yes, we lived there, we travelled there, and of course we went to things like the Boris Festival and
yes. And
other festivals around town, and we drove around quite a lot. So quite a lot of time in Ireland, and the orange food poisoning from carrot juice, I think, was very memorable.
The carrot juice, you're saying it was the early days of carrot juice in Ireland.
It was the early days of carrot juice, I think, everywhere, and I don't think people had got a firm handle on it.
The essentials had evidently not been mastered, is the way you've put it.
The Irish were very kind.
Were they? Good.
They all stood around my prostrate form in the train station and said, "Oh, is she having a heart attack? Should we call the ambulance?"
But to be very precise, they're Jesus, Mary and Joseph, do we call it?
Yeah,
I didn't expect we'd start this interview with you vomiting on a train station in Ireland, but such is life.
The memoir is what you can remember, yeah. And those sorts of things are very memorable.
It really is. One of the other parts that we love is your description of overhearing Irish women discussing your literature on a train in Ireland.
Yes, that was just before the orange food poisoning. So Graham was having a snooze, and I was eavesdropping on four Irish readers who were across the aisle. And much to my surprise, they were discussing my work.
Oh, wow.
And they were saying, "Well, I thought her latest one was a little long." Yes, I thought it was a little long. Yes, and it was a little long. So that was my age of long books, was in the 80s and 90s.
That comment stayed with you, didn't it?
Well, wouldn't it, if you were a writer? Oh, my heavens, is it a little long?
I just extraordinary. Those women who were discussing your book, they had no idea that Margaret Atwood was...
Well, they didn't know I was listening, but they were having a frank literary discussion. And as you know, the Irish are very keen on literary tradition.
True.
And there was a time, in which it appears to be over, in which the upholstery on Aer Lingus was embroidered with the names of Irish writers.
Yeah.
So you could be sitting on James Joyce or Jonathan Swift. And maybe they rethought that, but I thought it was pretty neat. And it was also true at that time when we used to go hiking in Galway, you would drop into a little pub, mm-hmm. and an English little pub of that kind would have a picture of horses or maybe prize pigs or something on the wall. And they had George Bernard Shaw.
Yeah. And
like that.
The death of writers.
Do you remember that? Is that still going on?
Absolutely. And the death of writers is headline news here in a way that it would be alien to perhaps British consumers of news and so on. And we still have days to celebrate writers.
Well, you know, Kingsley Amis, I think, was a headliner. But no, I think it's something that has always been there, the bardic tradition morphing into books, and lots of people read, and so it's not unusual that you would find four women on a train discussing what they'd just read.
No, just as savage as they were.
Well, I don't think they were savage.
The criticism,
I think it was
yeah.
true. They it was a little long.
It wasn't. Okay, you took it aboard. When you were living in Ireland, you were finishing off Alias Grace. Is that correct?
Yes. I had finished it, and we didn't have an address as such, and it was in the days before the internet, so they had to courier me the corrected galleys and editorial comments. So they put them in a courier package, and I got a call from the courier company saying, "Where exactly are you?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, you go down this road and I will hang a tea towel out on a shrub and that will be the house." And that worked like a charm.
It was near Newmarket in Cork.
No, I got the name wrong. It was near Union Hall in Cork.
Oh, so it's Union and Hall.
Who spotted that one? The Dutch translators.
Really?
And, well, we looked up Newmarket, and you can't get here from there, and it's nowhere near Skibbereen, so what's going on? And I thought, oh, my goodness. Union Hall and Newmarket are not very memorable names. So I got them mixed up. But we've corrected it.
Did they find the tea towel?
At least in the audio book. It'll be corrected. So, yes, Union Hall, and the Gaelic name, and I checked this with an Irish friend, mm-hmm. means smelly beach. So it's on an estuary, and apparently there was a famous battle there in about the year 900, and the corpses washed out to sea, and then they washed in again. And then they washed out, and then they washed in. And after that had happened a few times, it was very smelly. So that's why it's called Smelly Beach.
What else do you remember about your time in Ireland? It's the mid-1990s around Cork. Did you get a sense of the place?
We didn't go to the city of Cork much. We were in West Cork, and it's a little microclimate there.
Yeah.
So where everywhere else had miserable weather, we really had quite nice weather. It was the time when there was a huge gale on the Atlantic and several fishing boats were lost. So I remember that part. And we were also living there when they blew up Canary Wharf. Do you remember that?
Of course, yes, we do.
Yes. And it was also the time of the mad cow disease.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the result of that was that I couldn't give blood after that, because they would all always ask you, "Have you been in the UK? Have you been in Ireland?
Wow.
Do you eat any hamburgers?"
The CJD, yeah, Creutzfeldt-Jakob
disease. Yeah, so they
disease.
Did not. They did not want to take that chance. So yes, we had a lovely time. We went walking a lot. And we did go to Skibbereen, which was our market town. Mm-hmm. And we were there on a day in which we were going to go to the bank, and there was this big ring of police all the way around it and a Brinks truck. And I said, "Oh, my goodness, has there been a bank robbery?" They said, no, it's just a precaution because the IRA likes to rob banks on cash delivery days.
Gosh.
So all of that was going on at the time. And, of course, we used to go to Galway quite a bit, mm-hmm. as well as Cork. And I was at the Galway Festival in March of 2020. Do you remember what happened then?
We do. We're trying to forget it, but it's
yeah,
there.
Yes, we're all trying to forget it.
It's sitting with
so
us.
So I come from Australia and New Zealand, and we were doing the Galway Festival. And I did manage to do my things. But then right after that, the COVID struck and we all had to flee. And I got back to Canada on the 10th of March. And I think they closed things down on the 13th or the 14th.
Mm-hmm. You got out just in time. You could have been still here.
I could have been still there, yes. I could have been moldering in a churchyard somewhere.
Dear.
Yeah, so that was quite a weird time.
Yeah. One of the things, of course, we have about Ireland is we see ourselves as a rural place, a green place, but nothing compares quite to the descriptions of where you were living as a child in Canada, as you say, north of Ottawa. It's proper wilderness, wasn't it?
Yeah, proper wilderness, but below the tree line. So if we really want to go northy north, there's much more north above the tree line that you could go to, which I have. And that's when you get into the rock and the tundra, and you go even further north and you find the graves of the first people who died on the Franklin expedition. They're up there on Beachy Island.
They went searching for the Northwest Passage.
Yes. A big controversy at the time, because John Ray, who actually found the remains, said they'd been eating each other, and Lady Franklin was not pleased.
No.
No, because it's one thing to have a heroic husband who has died in a heroic undertaking, and another thing to have
survival tactics. Thankfully, you didn't have to resort to cannibalism to get through the forest life in Canada.
No, not quite.
And no, your winters in the city.
We ate a lot of Spam, which is not quite the same thing.
But it was a proper bucolic existence. It wasn't farming, but you had no running water, no toilets outside, no electricity, obviously. Your father was there for a very good reason.
Yes, he was a forest entomologist, which means insects.
Yeah.
And he was a field researcher at that time, which meant out in the woods, which suited him just fine. And it was during the war, and forestry in Canada was considered a crucial war industry.
Yeah, this was his contribution, wasn't it, your dad?
He got paid for it. He was a bit old for the army. Mm-hmm. He wanted to be a pilot, but they wouldn't let him in because he had a heart condition. Anyway, there you are. That's the war. But we were up in the woods, and I still spend part of the summer up in the same location.
And you would have heard lots of wolves and seen a lot of bears. This would have stoked your imagination.
Bears, yes. Wolves heard, mm-hmm. not seen. Wolves generally keep out of the way of people if they can.
But you heard them. It must have stoked your writer's brain quite a bit, being out there in the wilderness.
Well, all sorts of things stoke writers' brains, and there is no formula. So Marcel Proust's childhood was quite different from mine, but he became a writer too. Mm-hmm. And, we won't mention James Joyce's childhood, which from all accounts wasn't very pleasant.
Your mum was also a scientist, but perhaps her heart wasn't in it?
She went through in home economics, which is what people did in those days, and they presented it as a science, but basically it was housekeeping with measurements. But that's what you did, and then you could teach it, which is what she did. And she wasn't that interested in it at all. She was interested in horseback riding and being out in the woods and canoeing, and she was a very good speed skater and skier, so she was very athletic.
When you're 8 or 9 years of age, you experience being bullied, don't you, by another girl in your class?
A little group of them.
Yeah. This obviously is a focus of the 1988 novel, Cat's Eyes, about the toxic relationship between girls.
Relationship between girls had not been much explored at that time, so there was this fantasy that boys were rambunctious and mean and girls were well-behaved and cute.
Right.
That's not true. And anybody who's been a girl at school knows it's not true. So, yes, their methods are different, but they're both interested in hierarchical pecking orders. It's just that boys arrange theirs differently. You usually have to be good at something to get status, or the biggest and tallest and strongest and most aggressive. Whereas girls, it's more like the Byzantine court with whisperings and favorites and sudden changes of status and envy and that kind of thing going on.
At the reaction to Cat's Eye, people were quite astonished in some ways, worried, but also it was familiar to them, wasn't it, this world?
I got a huge amount of mail about that book. It was before the internet, so it was, you know, these things called letters that had that thing called stamps on them.
Yes.
And so some were from parents, oh, finally we understand what's going on, what can we do? Some were from ex-girls who had grown up, many of whom had been in the down position, but some of whom confessed to have been the instigators and perpetrators.
Wow.
I thought it was pretty honest of them.
Yeah.
And some of them were from former boys who said, I never did understand what was going on.
Oh, really?
Girls, but now I do.
The revelation was there.
Then there was the revelation, yes. Wow. This is what they do.
What was really going on? I presume they were seeing all this behavior at home and trying to find their own bit of power when they went to school.
Yeah, I think that's true of one of them. But I think also I was just a very naive, gullible person who believed what people told me because I hadn't had experience otherwise.
At 16, then, you've a great English teacher, don't you? And you start writing poetry.
Yes, I have a wonderful English teacher called Miss Bessie Billings.
Great name.
And, that's when I started writing, not because of Miss Bessie Billings, who had one memorable thing to say about my poetry, which was, I don't understand this at all, dear, so it must be good.
A very good poetry critic.
But she also said that I should go to a particular college at the university because it had the best English department. So that's where I went.
And you start reading science fiction. I think George Orwell, too, aren't you? Maybe you're supposed to be doing your homework.
I start reading science fiction very early. Mm-hmm. So I start reading it probably about the age of 11 or 12. And that's about when George Orwell comes out in paperback in a very trashy cover. But this was the age when you could buy all kinds of books in the pharmacy. They had racks of them. And a lot of classics would turn up with really trashy covers on them.
Yes.
So I think a lot of people got their early reading experience by buying the book with the blonde and the negligee and thinking it was going to be hot stuff. And really, it was War and Peace.
That's very good.
So that was going on. And Ray Bradbury, George Orwell, Brave New World, and a lot of pulp magazines, which often had quite memorable stories in them.
The titles you're mentioning there, of course, Totalitarianism, Propaganda feature heavily. And these are themes you brought to your own novel, The Handmaid's Tale.
I didn't even have to read books because it was the Cold War.
Yes.
During that time, in fact, it was an intense phase of the Cold War in the 60s in the 50s, continuing on into the 60s and 70s and 80s. But the really scary part, I would say, would be in the 50s and early 60s. The Cuban Missile Crisis was then. And, of course, that produced John le Carré, who I think happened to think is a really good writer.
Amazing.
I read all of that and I thought James Bond was pretty spurious, but
yeah.
Maybe that was because I had a boyfriend who was very keen on him.
Right. What leads you to, because it's 1984 when you were writing The Handmaid's Tale. You're also in Berlin, are you?
I wrote it in, I started typing it out in Berlin. I had some notes and things and early thoughts about it. My early thoughts about it got put in a drawer because I thought it was too bonkers, even for me.
Wow.
But then I started it again after the novel I'd been writing in Blakeney, England, had really fallen apart. So I was writing it on a German electric typewriter with different letters in different positions from English ones, but that's okay because I don't touch type. The atmosphere, however, was very helpful. So there we were in West Berlin with the wall all the way around us.
Yeah.
Supersonic airplanes making booms every Sunday just to remind us that they were there. It was easy for me as a Canadian to go across to East Berlin, which we did. Not so easy for Germans. Then we also went to Czechoslovakia at that time and Poland. So I had a a good exposure to various phases of totalitarian rule.
Where people had to be careful about what they said, and you had to be careful about what
people wouldn't talk to you at all in East Berlin unless you were a child. In Czechoslovakia, they would, but you had to go out into a field because they rightly assumed that everything, including their car, was bugged. And in Poland, they were quite loosey-goosey. So I thought, if it crumbles, it'll crumble in Poland first, which it then did.
Did you always have the Puritans in mind as the kind of beginnings of your totalitarian regime, that they would use the puritanical origin story?
Every country, you never get to start from zero. So every country has a past, and things that come out in the present usually have some roots in the past. And I studied the Puritans in the early 60s under this genius called Perry Miller, who had brought them back into, who had brought them into academic study. And the Massachusetts Bay Colony was not a democracy, just to share that with you. The Puritan fathers were not in search of an open, religiously tolerant society. They were in search of setting up their own and kicking out everybody else, which is what they did. So, yes, the roots of...
A real point of interest for you is your own ancestors.
Yes, absolutely. The place is crawling with them. I've got a lot of distant relatives on Cape Cod and in Massachusetts and New Hampshire and in Connecticut, which is where those people went. And you're probably interested in Half-Hanged Mary, the...
Incredible story.
What a story.
It is.
So she gets accused of witchcraft, and let us just say that everybody believed there were witches. It's not something these people just made up out of nothing.
Yeah.
And it was a widespread European belief. The New England colonies didn't burn witches. They hanged them, by the way.
From trees.
She got accused of witchcraft before the Salem incident. Got taken to Boston, was exonerated, declared innocent, went back to her hometown of Hadley, Massachusetts. The townspeople were not satisfied with the verdict, and they strung her up. It's before the drop was invented, so her neck was not broken. They strung her up on a tree and came in the morning to cut down the body, and she was still alive, which gave her the nickname Half-Hanged Mary.
And she lives for 14 more years.
She lived for 14 more years, and I guess they left her alone after that because they probably thought she really was a witch. Her last name was Webster. All of those Websters in New England are related, and my grandmother was a Webster. Some of them went to Nova Scotia after 1760. And you remember what happened in 1760. New France fell to General Wolfe. Okay, so, and the Acadians, a lot of them got deported to Louisiana, giving us the name Cajun, because they wouldn't swear an oath to the king. That land was then opened up to people called planters, and a bunch of them came from New England. And the Websters were among them. So Grandmother Webster used to say on Mondays that we were related to Half-Hanged Mary. And on Wednesdays, she would think better of it and say, maybe we weren't.
It might change then.
Not sure. I think she had second thoughts about maybe we shouldn't claim this.
The witch hunt is evoked all the time in modern politics. And indeed, your book was back in the news recently, another school library's book ban, which took you off the shelf, this time in Alberta, Canada. We have come to expect these things in the US, but not what we thought was the much more sensible Canada. Your reaction was a short story.
We've had them for a while. I remember some back in the 70s of people being outraged by Margaret Lawrence and taking her, getting her book kicked off the school library. So let's be clear that, these are not full-out book burnings. They get taken off school curricula and out of libraries, but they're not actually piling, at least I don't think they are.
No.
I don't think they're piling them up in piles and setting fire to them. Anyway, this was the premier of Alberta. His name is Daniel Smith, and she uttered an unfortunately vague mandate to school, to library boards. And really, it said anything with direct or indirect sex in it had to come out. So nobody knew what indirect...
Yeah, they kind of made it up themselves.
What is that? Somebody had a baby, is that indirect sex? I guess it has to be. So the Edmonton board made a list of things that had to be banned that included just about every classic on the planet. And that is when people got up in arms and said, what on earth are you talking about? And I put out a tweet with a suitable short story that could not possibly be objected to, in which John and Mary are very well behaved all the time. So I think the Alberta government retracted very quickly because they realized that the statement they had made was not operable. And they clarified and said, no, they were only talking about graphic novels that had actual sexual intercourse going on in pictures.
It's good that embarrassment can have that force, isn't it? It really is. Liz and Margaret, it's such a joy to read. And there's beautiful things about your family and about your partner, Graham, as well. What does a great writer do now after memoir?
But, you know, there's a shelf life. I'm not looking at an endless future of, well, never mind. We won't go there.
You're still on that shelf, as has to be said, on the shelves.
Yes. I'm still here, oddly enough, and lovely to talk to you.
Likewise. Book of Lives, a memoir of sorts, is out now. Margaret Atwood, it's been so much fun. Thank you.
Thank you.
Text 51551. Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.